Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. This week, Morris Kirk, 3 weeks into his 3-month trial. Plus, our weekly news update. Today it's going to be Mark Higgins giving that. Also, Alan Frankovich, Peruvian-born film genius documentary maker. Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. We resume hearing from him. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join us, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So straight off this week with Morris Kirk, who's hot off from Cardiff, from the courts. Morris, first of all, just set the scene. What's it been like in the courtroom?
Well, I think I referred earlier to Dickens' Bleak House and the legal action that took many, many years, Jarndyce and Jarndyce. Well, I started this action 20 years ago and employed solicitors here in Bristol for a short time. But I've been doing it on my own virtually ever since. And it's a harassment action against 20 years of bullying by the South Wales Police. And I am there on my own, and I have to cross-examine nearly 100 police officers. And we're into the fourth week, so I'm a third of the way through. No, I'm not. That's a quarter of the way through this 3-month trial. And today was at least comical. At least I didn't have to stretch my brain very much. They had to answer for the burden of proof is on the police, because I am out to prove harassment, and from high ranking officers, not the men on the beat. And today, for example, they had to admit that they launched a helicopter from Cardiff, a helipad, on receiving a phone call from a female saying that they believed I was flying in South Wales without a pilot's licence, in my famous cub that's got me most of the way around the world. Now, if you can imagine Morris flying without a licence, well, so be it. But for me to then ask for permission to enter Cardiff Zone and then land at my airstrip at St Donat's next to the famous castle... One of the very early questions to this police officer, retired, this was 15 years ago. Why didn't you just send a panda car 2 miles from Lantwit Major and knock on my door and say, do you have a driving licence for your aeroplane parked outside your kitchen window, along with my yak and along with an old Oster?
So and we're talking about a yak aircraft,
yes.
not a bit of livestock.
No. And, the case fell into a farce. But the other aviation case that they had to finish this morning was even funnier, because they said that... how was it now? I took off from a farmer's field at night at 5 a.m. with my girlfriend. This was, again, 15, 14 years ago. And we flew to Ireland to hunt with the County Meath foxhounds. And in order to be able to do it at a weekend, I couldn't leave on Friday because it was winter, January. So, February the 9th. And so I got permission to move the aircraft out of Cardiff Airport into a farmer's field, because the weather was so bad next day, they wouldn't let me fly out of an international airport because the aircraft and myself weren't licensed sufficient to be able to fly out. So a few weeks later, I'm approached by the police saying, we understand that you flew to Ireland on a certain day without clearing immigration, and apparently they had another anonymous phone call, a phone call that couldn't be established who'd made the call. It was rumoured that it was a gentleman from Dursley, just north of Bristol, who has featured in my life as an aircraft engineer.
But, I mean, you must understand, Maurice, that the police can't reveal when they've... You know, if you are going to report a crime, you want your name to be kept confidential, don't you? Everybody does that. I mean, that's a normal procedure.
Yes, well, that's very interesting, because we had a trial that followed, and they used the excuse that the police officer, halfway through the trial, suddenly remembered that he'd made written notes. And over the weekend, in the middle of the trial, he comes back with a set of written notes at the very short notice. And I wasn't allowed to see them as the litigant in person, an accused.
So, I mean, if you'd had a solicitor, would your solicitor have been able to see it? I mean, surely you can't introduce evidence like that halfway through a trial, can you?
You've raised an extremely important point.
It's called disclosure. You know, at the beginning, before the trial even takes place, both sides disclose the evidence that they intend to use.
I attempted to arrest this police officer on the spot, as is my habit, because I knew that it was falsified.
What, was that in court?
Yes. No. As soon as... Oh, no, you don't do it. I've learnt my lesson. I've got a 13-month prison conviction in Guernsey because I went to the judge and said, I am arresting you because the higher court has ordered you to produce a doctor with his records. And the police swarmed in and knocked his table over. And because he was still sitting, they turned it round to say that I was arresting him and therefore assaulting him. And of course, I just stood there in the court. So I don't think I'm going to make that mistake again. I wait until the magistrate has left the room.
Remember, Maurice, never arrest judges and policemen in the court itself. Always wait till they're outside.
No. As soon as one of them is standing, the case is no longer sitting. You can arrest a magistrate or a judge once he's standing. And look, I know about these things. Now, you raised the important matter of litigant in person. If I'd had a solicitor that I could trust in South Wales, of course, I would have employed one. And normally, they would be given documents of that sort. But of course, it's a closed shop.
I mean, can't you appeal yourself to the judge and say, hang on a minute, he can't introduce this at the last minute?
And the judge herself, a stipendiary magistrate, a lawyer herself, she saw the photocopy, and I said, no, under the laws of best evidence, we want to see the original, because he says there is two lots of writing on the document that he's found over the weekend, and it also has the name of the informant. And due to the incompetence of certain parties, I saw the name and his phone number, a man known to me. But the prosecution then, from London, this was London CPS because it was an anti-terrorism prosecution, brought down top people. And I warned him. I said, you aren't dealing with the Met. You're dealing with the South Wales Police. You watch your back. And he took the opportunity to say, I withdraw my action against Mr. Kirk on behalf of the Queen, which is what he meant, on behalf of the Queen. And Mr. Kirk has no case to answer. Now, I won 90% of the allegations thrown at me in 8 years by the South Wales Police, and it's my turn. And it's becoming very clear in the last 3 weeks that they never expected me to run 20 years, because of course in those 20 years, you've heard a little bit about it, each time this trial has been listed for 3 months, they have locked me up on spurious things like having a machine gun and having...
We ought to remind listeners that this was actually a not working old machine gun from an old rusty aeroplane.
Yes, it was a Lewis machine gun from the First World War. And Brian Trabshaw of Bristol renown, our test pilot for 002 Concorde, was a personal friend of mine for many years. And he invited me to fly this aircraft at Farnborough. And after a year of having it, I sold it. And a year later, the police arrested me and quickly changed its colour to silver because the museum had painted it silver. So for the jury, they painted it black, which is what it was when I owned it. But when they lost the case, they had to paint it silver again. And I still hold a statement from Lincolnshire Air Museum saying it even came back to us a different shade of silver. That's the level of the evidence going on now in the civil action for damages for 20 years of this conduct.
Yeah, it sounds pretty horrific. But, OK, let's go back to basics, almost starting from the beginning again. What court are you in? Is this a civil or criminal law?
Well, I'm in the civil court. I was promised a jury by the Bristol solicitors. Otherwise, I would never have started.
Sorry,
I thought
you weren't having solicitors.
No.
You've got rid of the solicitors.
No, they promised me that I would start this action. I said, I'm not letting go. I was harassed out of Taunton. I went to Guernsey to set up. They stole my building business, and my partner was bankrupted by the administration of Guernsey. And I fought them for 10 years. My children went to Clifton College and various schools in Bristol. I said, they're not going to be educated in Guernsey because the place stinks. And I said, I will not have my children being polluted.
Well, it's a tax haven, isn't it, Guernsey? Isn't it?
Well, it's an IRA safe home house.
But isn't it a safe house for just about every crook on the planet?
Yes. Yes, it is. And it was when I was there. And they thought I was going to join. And I'm sorry.
Were you ever formally approached, or was that a bit more subtle than that?
I think we'll say it was more subtle than that. But getting back to South Wales, on Thursday, in 2 days, I'm before Lord Leveson. I'm before Lord Leveson in the Criminal Court of Appeal for apparently harassing the chief psychiatrist for the South Wales Police, a Dr. Tegan Williams. And he has written statements saying that I've been around to his house harassing him, and I've been jailed all last summer. And the statement I need before Lord Leveson on Thursday, it's called a victim statement, section 9, MG 11, which I have seen in custody. I spent several months in Cardiff prison, and then they dropped all charges because they realized that I didn't have significant brain damage and that the doctor had fabricated the allegations, which of course is what he did 3 years ago when they tried to stop the machine gun case from starting, when they made out and he applied personally before Judge Neil Bidder on the 2nd of December 2009. I was in the cells below beating at the doors because I knew something was going on. I do all my own cases. If they're important ones, I do them myself. And he was asking that I was so dangerous that I should be sent to Ashworth High Security. Now, his lordship, Lord Leveson, in 48 hours, has to consider whether I have the right to appeal, because I went before the judge on the 4th of May last year, and he would not let me have my legal papers to give evidence. In fact, I wasn't allowed to give any evidence at all. And the transcript clearly dictates that, well, can I get my legal papers and give evidence? I have exhibits, and my witnesses wish to follow evidence, and I have exhibits for them. They're in the cellar below, in the cells below. And he said, no, you'll give evidence without legal papers. I then attempted to do exactly what I did in the machine gun case, which a certain left-wing newspaper picked up and made a big story of.
So you've taken it to the civil court.
Yeah.
What kind of action exactly is it? And I mean, for most of us, even if we are annoyed with someone, we believe someone's doing something, we ourselves wouldn't know how to actually get a court case rolling on our behalf. How do you do that, Maurice?
Well, because of the harassment by the South Wales Police and my experiences in Guernsey, I've become a bit of a barrack room lawyer on the subject of criminal law, and I'm actually very interested in it, because to me, you either threw the brick through the window or you didn't, and to me it's very clear, and I actually get quite interested in the aspects of law. But this today, for the next 3 months, is in the civil court, the Cardiff Civil Justice Centre, every day. and I have over 200 Leverage files. And the judge commented on it today, because I'm up against a QC, a Queen's Counsel, a trailing barrister.
No, the QC is working for South Wales Police.
Yes. And they have a team of solicitors, including a senior partner of the lawyers who took this on. And what's been very interesting today is, of course, I gave them 55 Leverage files 6 or 7 years ago, saying, this is my record of each of the magistrates' cases that I've won. Remember, I've won 90%, and that means about 90 court cases. And
don't you ever think to yourself, well, I need to drop all this and, you know, get on with my life and forget all the legal stuff?
Yes, but they sent me a bill of £500,000 should I back out 3 years ago, 4 years
right,
ago.
So that's an attempt to sort of... But I mean, have you got £500,000 to pay them?
If I rob a bank.
I mean, surely, Maurice, there's an aspect to all of this where you know, that it's part of you must be thinking, well, I just want to forget about all this and get on with my life.
Yes, but I went to solicitors unwisely in Bristol, and they said, you will get a jury. And the little blighters let me have a jury for 3 or 4 years, as promised. And then the judge even did better. He said, you can take a choice out of the 40, 50 incidents. Remember, I was stopped 35 times to produce my insurance on the roadside or within 7 days at a nominated police station. And every time I had valid insurance, or more to the point, they were satisfied with the document. So on the 35th time, I said, well, I used an expression, and meaning I was not going to do it anymore. I'd had enough. And I won that court case. And that's legal history in the United Kingdom for somebody who is made to produce his insurance and driving license, refusing. Now, I was running along having a jury, because that's the only way to deal with actions against the police, is to have a jury. And then suddenly they overturned it by appeal. And the appeal was a farce. It was in Swansea. And it was a 20-second wonder. And the higher court judge said, no, it's too document heavy. You've got too many files. I said, but it's only 35 motoring offences, mainly motoring offences, alleged offences, which they've lost. And I said, each case is so simple. I either went through the red light, and of course, in a lot of my cases, they had me positive on the roadside, and within 20 minutes in the police station, zero reading on the definitive machine, which meant something sinister had happened. But not once, not twice, I think it's 4 times in the 35 cases. And that is the background of all this. And of course, when they took...
I'm trying to get you to answer the question.
Yes,
which is why not just drop it all and get on with your life?
Sorry, I can't drop it because 3 or 4 years ago I had a tentative bill of 500,000, and now today it will be close on £1 million because we're 3 weeks into a trial with a QC, trailing barrister, senior partner of a firm, at least 3 or 4 runners and tea makers and clerks running around in and out of that court all the time, and I'm on my own. And the press, mind you, the Western Press, the Western Mail and the Evening Post, the main newspapers in South Wales, have been given an unofficial D notice. That is to say that my friends who've been following me for the last 20 years, my ardent supporters and Mackenzie friends, have each in turn, 5 times they've gone into the head office of these newspapers, just 50 yards from my front door of this court. They only have to cross the road to go in. And they've been told, we didn't know about it. 5 people have gone in over the last 3 weeks. And they each deny knowing anything about the biggest South Wales Police court case they've ever had in living memory. Now, something very, very sinister is going on, which is why I have my website.
Okay, just a reminder to your web address again.
Kirkflyingvet.com.
Okay. Now, you're in the civil case. It's in the civil courts. You're looking at 3 months. And what essentially are you? You're saying that there's been a specific targeting of you as an individual by the police, that they have, sort of been stopping you, this kind of thing, over what period of time?
Well, it started in Taunton.
Somerset, surely.
Yes, I know.
Police.
It was in Taunton when I was a veterinary surgeon in Taunton, and I was accused of purloining the chief superintendent's notebook from his office in his police station. And I was found not guilty in a Cardiff Crown Court. I, in fact, did take that notebook, but I did not steal it. I was facing shotgun charges. And the content of that notebook was read out to the jury in Crown Court in Bristol. And I was acquitted without having to give any evidence at all. That is the seriousness of it. But they have hounded me ever since.
But I come back to what I was saying, Maurice, isn't it? Why can't you just, turn your back on the court case and go and get on with your life? I mean, you obviously, you're saying that you're facing a big bill, but surely by carrying on with it, you're facing an even bigger bill.
Well, the bill is in the region of £1 million at the moment. Are you thinking that I have £1 million to give them? Well, I wish to cross that bridge on the last day of the trial back into England and never set foot in Wales. South Wales, this is only the administration of South Wales, that is the Assembly and the police and the Crown Prosecution Service. Remember, I was a veterinary surgeon there for 20 years. Well, it was the best part of, and thoroughly enjoyed it, and lots of friends. And I'm going to, the farmers, just like Somerset, really wonderful memories.
Yeah, so you're gonna, in 3 months' time, you're going to win or not?
Well, it's a bit like a boxing match. They're scoring based on I have to show malice, harassment and bullying. And each day I make a little score, and I've been getting 7 out of 10 to 9 out of 10 if it was a boxing match.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Maurice. Now some music.
Thank you.
from Her Majesty's Secret Service, the Bond film. And before that, you heard litigant in person, Maurice Kirk. If you want to follow more about cases where people are fighting those cases on their own, or they believe they're victims of miscarriages of justice, you can go to victims-unite on the internet. That's Sabine McNeill's website. She's not with us this week because she's doing something in the House of Commons today. So she emailed me to say she won't be able to be hearing from her next week. So that's victims-unite.net. And Maurice Kirk's specific website, where you can read a bit more about his case if you want to, is www.kirkflyingvet.com. That's kirkflyingvet.com. Well, now I'm joined by Mark Higgins. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you've been along for a few weeks, but this is the first time you've sort of plunged in, taking over from Jason in a way, and
stepping
doing a bit of a news review. So you've picked out a few stories for us this week. What you got?
So a story that struck me in one of the nationals here is a piece about a house that was a squat that's been sold in London for a record £80 million. The piece reads, "An end of terrace former squat has sold for £80 million in one of Britain's biggest ever property deals." And the reason this story struck me is I've had quite a few friends that have squatted over the years. And in a similar property, in a place called Rootham in Kent, there was quite a large sort of mansion property with quite a few people living there. But the kind of ethos behind it was using the space creatively, making the most of what would otherwise be basically a wasted building or an empty building not going to good use. So it kind of made me think a little bit about, you hear quite a lot of negative press and a lot of negative portrayal about people who squat, and people don't necessarily think about why they do it and what the motivations behind doing it is.
So, well, the other thing, of course, is you go back right to literally to medieval times. Squatting's always been a right in this country. If there's a building that's unused, unoccupied, derelict in whatever way, that you have a right to do it. And also there's a kind of sort of, it's a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it, in times when, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of someone that's got no roof over their head and you walk past a building which has been empty for a year, 2 years, 6 months or whatever, you think to yourself, well, look, you know, there's an open window in there, why should I sleep in the street?
That's it. And of course, you know, you mentioned the right there that goes way back to the common law medieval times, but obviously nowadays, in the last 12 months or so, this has changed. So there's been a law passed that it's now a criminal offence to squat. So,
well, it's a squat in, it's a criminal offence to squat in a residential property. That is to say, if it's a house, if it's designed for, to be a home, then the police can then come and get you out under the criminal law. In other words, the landlord, rather than calling his solicitor to go to court to get you out through the civil courts, that is where he has to prove ownership and all that kind of thing, all he has to do now, or she, is to phone up the police.
Sure. I've kind of been a little bit out of the loop as far as these things are concerned, so I don't really know what the consequences of that legislation has been and how that's had an impact on people who might have otherwise chosen to squat, and really what, you know, the legal implications are for people that do still make that choice.
Well, basically, if you're in a residential property, we had a guy on here, this is probably 6 months ago, who we think was probably one of the first people in Bristol to actually be evicted under this new law. He wasn't actually arrested. The police just said, well, if you don't get out of the building, we will arrest you. Now, of course, this leaves lots of other types of premises open for squatters still. Now, the question with this story that you've brought up here that I have to ask is, I wonder, okay, so the building was empty for a long time, now it's been sold, is the person who's bought it actually going to live in it? It might sound like a no-brainer. For most of us buying a house, we would then move straight in. But nowadays, it seems quite a lot, particularly with these big rich houses.
I was going to say,
they're just an investment, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. There's a lot of people, I don't want to sort of pinpoint any particular part of the world, but the cliche that's banded about at the moment is rich Saudis and the like, you know, who would buy a central London property with no intention of actually moving in there. So it's been sold for £80 million. What's the possibility that it could become a squat again within the next 6 months?
With a different owner or a different landlord.
Right. Yes. But in the same paper, there was a similar story. Excuse the rustling. A story in a similar vein to do with the recent relaxation of the planning laws, try and encourage developers to build on a much broader spectrum of spaces, and obviously the kind of political tagline with that is easing the housing crisis as well. So I thought that tied in quite nicely with the squatting story there.
Well, yeah, but you're saying that, but there's no shortage of places for people to build houses or convert. I mean, with all these empty offices, we've got, I think it's in it, isn't it, something like 40 acres of empty office space in Bristol. Mm. It's not as if there's a shortage of space, but these housing developers, they take the mickey. Mm. They want to build on a nice greenfield site. They want to buy a field which will cost them about maybe £4,000, £5,000 an acre, mm. rather than to buy building land, which is much more expensive. So they're trying to do it on the cheap, building mm. on the green belt in the process.
That was something that I was wondering, how far can it be said that the relaxation of the planning laws is there to relieve this sort of so-called housing crisis or to actually generate additional revenue?
Well, it's just, I mean, you know, it seems to me it's about meaning that the bottom line is better for the developers, for the yeah. builders. They are actually making more money because they're paying less for greenfield sites than they would for brownfield sites or for old factory sites doing conversion jobs. I mean, at the moment, we've got several conversion jobs going on around the city docks. That they will be being sold as luxury flats. They'll be making a lot of money there, but not the case if you haven't got a site like that. If you're buying the land cheap, if you're buying the building cheap, then you're obviously going to make more money on it, and that seems to be what's motivating this. There's no shortage of building land.
Obviously, it's quite a strong tagline, housing crisis. Throw in the word crisis in there, you know.
But there is a housing crisis. I mean, in this city, we've got between 15,000 and 20,000 homeless people that desperately need somewhere to live. That is people either, you know, living in very cramped conditions or else, you know, more street homeless, people squatting. Mm. You know, that's the problem.
Mm. And I wonder how far back it goes. You know, can it be said that there's always been this, inverted commas, housing crisis in big cities and big towns? Is this, you know, something that's been part
no.
of...
No. I mean, I can tell you, because I can remember back in the 1980s when you first started seeing people out sleeping on the streets in London. I mean, when I was brought up in the 70s, everybody had somewhere to go, whether it's a hostel bed or whatever. In the 1980s, with the Thatcher... generation, you started getting people, and I remember sort of almost like saying to my friends, oh god, what's this, someone's actually begging, I can't believe it.
Of course, because you know? she removed the cap on what landlords could charge, didn't she?
As is happening right now in Bristol, money was being taken from the government away from provision for emergency housing for people. So, you know, then people are turning up at wherever it is at the city council saying, I need housing. And they say, well, sorry, we can't help you today. Come back tomorrow or go somewhere else. Or, you know, it's a sort of pass the buck routine now. Mm. And I happen to know somebody that I'm in touch with, whose daughter works for the council. She is scared to death that there's going to be a news story tomorrow about someone they've had to turn away from the city council housing department.
Wow.
Okay, so those two definitely connected, in you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, both, I suppose, to do with the crisis. It seems to me the obvious answer to a lot of this, I don't know what you think, is to actually to open up some of these offices for people to live in, or, you know, empty buildings or empty houses.
Or, yeah, encourage rich Saudis to buy properties in Clifton, and then we'll go down Stokes Croft, round up some homeless. And
well, I mean, the council, you're saying that, but the council are trying to encourage people who have empty homes to do something with them. You know what? What we need to try and figure out is how it pays somebody to leave their property empty. Mm. I mean, this is the carriage works on Stokes Croft, and, you know, we've had all sorts of history in Bristol of various buildings that have been empty for years and years, decades even. Mm. How can you, as the owner of a property, justify doing absolutely nothing with it?
Sure. I mean, I've worked with someone a couple of years ago who inherited a home after his parents passed away. So he found himself in a situation where he had an empty house, and he was desperately scared that, you know, it would end up getting opened up and end up being used as a squat. So, you know, there are obviously some circumstances, some situations like that one. But then, like you say, something like the carriage works, as long as I've been in Bristol, it's been a kind of derelict, empty shell of a building, and it seems like a dreadful waste.
It is a waste. It's a terrible, it's a criminal waste. Mm. Look, The other thing about all this, of course, is that more and more people are seeing property as an investment, as an alternative to something like the stock market. You know, they're thinking that the commodity markets, the stock markets, the banks aren't paying the interest they used to be. You know, when your million is in the bank, it's not delivering the kind of returns that you might want. So, you know, it's just an alternative to putting money in the bank buying property for a lot of people nowadays.
And then it's kind of taking resources away from people on the ground floor, I suppose.
Yeah. And also, well, you're talking about the ground floors. This is another side to all of this, is that quite often office blocks, if you have a close look, if you stand back on the other side of the street, you'll see only the ground floor is actually being rented out. The idea is to make it look like it's, something's going on there. Actually, the first, second, third floor, fourth floor, fifth floor, sixth floor are all empty.
Wow.
So, yeah, the other thing on this homeless tip here is the old hub. Do you know that on Cumberland Street? It's just around the back of the old city council buildings where the Holiday is in the Bear Pit.
Okay.
Around the back of there, it's a sort of, there's a hidden away, slightly hidden away street, Cumberland Street. Now that's where the hub used to be, which was where everyone who's homeless in Bristol used to go to get some sort of, you know, chance at housing, even if it's just a bit of advice of where else that they, you know, they might get a hostel bed or whatever. That's now been closed. And the entire street is boarded up. So you've got the whole of one half of Cumberland Street boarded up. There's offices there. All sorts of stuff could be being done with it, but there's nothing happening at all, which I think is, again, a criminal waste.
Yeah,
and I would like to see that emptied, opened up and used.
Yeah. I mean, even if there are sort of long-term plans for it, it seems ridiculous to have it as a waste of space in the meantime. You know, they could let them be used as community spaces, and it only needs some kind of small supervision element to let other people make good use of the space for the meantime.
Okay, Mark Higgins, standing in for Jason Yannakopoulos this week. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. The Maltese Double Cross was never repeated, but can be watched online. It presents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the American CIA to blow up Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on the 21st of December 1988. Frankovich also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences back in 1992. That one documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof, and even the IRA. Frankovich died of a suspicious heart attack in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. Alongside the feature films of the Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us quite a deep insight into the criminal side of the Western intelligence services, such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence in Brussels. All these secret political operations were deniable, but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released a film, In Company Business, all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo.
They really didn't want the facts to come out that they were not winning the war in Vietnam, just like they don't want the facts to come out that the government they're supporting in El Salvador is losing the war.
Right.
Because the whole basis of this is to rather than do, you know, what any American president should do when this country's in a crisis, is to get on television and say, this is what we have to do there. We have just discovered that the Soviet Union is going to invade El Salvador and that we have to do this, that, and the other thing. No, what they do is, because they know that's not true. And in terms of Vietnam, for instance, one of the persons I interviewed in the film, and this is interesting, if you just remember the recent El Salvador election results, his name is Paul Sakwa. He was the chief of the Vietnam desk when Colby made his first tour in Vietnam. And he was reading to me cables of how the Vietnamese intelligence service was a completely owned adjunct of the CIA then and to the end, they were rigging the elections. He had these cables coming in, you know, were coming in there, reports from his people. And so, I mean, there you have, this is Diem, who the CIA later arranges to eliminate.
Right.
And here you have, you know, a government which invites the United States in, what the United States, first of all, brings to power. And so when it's like inviting yourself in, you know, it's like having yourself
and
a big
then manipulating the elections.
They're manipulating the elections so that you can bring in someone who will invite you in and make sure that someone who wants to kick you out. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that in terms of the Sam Adams story. But the problem is, how do you get accurate intelligence then if you're discouraging anyone who is trying to be honest and report information which he believes an American president should know in order precisely to preclude what happened in Iran? Was, you know, finally, I mean, the relationship that the United States have with Iran are non-existent because there's 30 years of secret history.
This is an important point, that the CIA is not really an intelligence agency. They're not providing accurate intelligence, which they're supposed to do by their charter. Rather, they're an arm of covert action. And isn't there something like six major issues where the CIA had either inaccurate information, or if they did, in the case of Iran and some Vietnam reports, they were at one place in the bureaucracy kept from the political decision people. So that they've really been a major failure as an intelligence agency.
No, because intelligence really is not what concerns you. You're dealing, you know, at the top level, you're dealing with economic interests. You're dealing with, why should the President of the United States listen to some little flunky CIA analyst who says, look, this thing in Iran is going to blow up in our faces, people are just going to get mad at us, they're going to kick us out, this whole thing is going to go to hell. When, at the same time, somebody's calling up and saying, look, you know, the Shah's our friend, and not only that, but we have major dealings, you know, we're getting $300 million by selling them helicopters. And you see, you have the irony that Iran is fighting the war with Iraq now with arms that the Shah bought. And the United States, you have every reason to believe that they're encouraging the Iraqis, but because, you know, they see the Iranian process as very dangerous, because it's a nationalist process. And if it spreads over into Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis realize that that the kings of Saudi Arabia have sold them down the river and will keep on selling them down the river forever, that'll have an impact. But the and you know, one of the most interesting examples in an interesting book, it just came out about the CIA intervention in Guatemala on the basis of the documents released. And it's clear that in 1953 or 54, when the CIA got involved in Guatemala, it had nothing at all to do with this communist threat. As a matter of fact, the CIA arranged to plant themselves Russian weapons in Nicaragua and arranged Somoza's discovery of them so that they could justify the communist threat. This comes out, these are actual CIA documents which state this. Mm. Now let's say there was a Soviet threat to Guatemala. And if the CIA is any kind of intelligence organization, it should be able to say and give to the president this information. And the president should be able to say, we are now invading Guatemala because there are... And if you go down, every instance, you go down to Guatemala, you go down to the Santo Domingo, the famous LBJ thing in Santo Domingo, where he came up with 35 known communists. And these people were enough of a threat to send in 30,000 Marines.
This
and
is in the Dominican Republic
other.
In 1965,
yes.
I think.
You go down every instance like that. Right. There always is the first thing, the other side is going to do this. Or, you know, in the case of Chile, you have the famous remark that Henry Kissinger made, which was then publicized after the Allende government was overthrown, that Chile is, like, the only threat to Chile is it's a dagger pointed to the heart of Antarctica. And nevertheless, they go down, they destroy the government, they kill the president, and they feel perfectly proper to do this. They feel no problem at all. They feel...
Okay, that was Alan Frankovich. He is speaking there to the Austin, Texas VHS, believe it or not, video news magazine called Alternative Views, way back in 1982. And it's interesting, I think, how some of the things he was saying about Iran, the idea of nationalism in Iran might spread to Saudi Arabia, is still so valid today. He was talking there, of course, just after the Iranian Revolution back in the late 1970s, early 1980s. So more from Alan Frankovich in future weeks.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, I'm joined now by Paul Fernie. Hi, Paul, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi there, Tony. How are you doing?
Now, you've got some stuff on astronomy. Tell us about, first of all, a bit about you. What got you into astronomy?
I got into astronomy years ago, basically, over 20 years ago. I was just interested. I was always looking up at night and just was fascinated by what I saw.
Okay, so any interest in astrology or is it just astronomy?
Mainly astronomy. I do read my stars every day, though.
Okay, any truth to it, do you think?
Ooh, I don't know about that, Tony. That's, yeah, sometimes they're true. Who knows?
I think you know what I think, that they just pull them out at random anyway. So what do you need to see the night sky, to see stars, planets, that kind of thing?
Well, really, Tony, we're actually equipped with the best thing to look, and that's our eyes. We get a better overall view of the sky with our eyes, and certainly the constellations, which are generally quite large. Again, a best seen with the eyes. You can use binoculars, you can use telescopes if you want to look at particular objects. However, you know, for just general sort of getting out there and having a look, your eyes are the best equipment.
Okay, and what can you see?
There's lots to see out there. Amongst other things, there's the stars, there's planets, the moon, with equipment, nebulas, galaxies. And
how do you tell the difference?
Now, stars flicker, whereas planets don't.
Okay, so a planet is a sort of constant light.
Yeah, a planet will present a constant light, whereas stars will flicker. It's because of stars are basically points of light, and they get disturbed by atmospheric conditions.
Okay, and how do you find, say, for example, I'm after looking at Mercury or Venus or something, how do you actually find it up there?
Okay, well, first of all, you should try and find your bearings. The easiest way to do this is at sort of sunset, I would say. If you stand with the sun setting on your right-hand side, you will be looking south at that point. The south is sort of the widescreen cinema of the night sky. That's where a lot of the action takes place. Planets appear at different times of the year in different places. Mercury and Venus are always very close to the sun because they're inside of our orbit, whereas the other planets all appear sort of through the night. Currently, probably one of the best ones to see at the moment is Jupiter, which is the fifth planet from the sun and the largest planet in the solar system.
So does that mean it's easiest to see?
It is at the moment, yeah. It's a really bright object. It's often confused as being a bright star or even Mars.
So what part of the sky is it in at the moment?
If you, around about 9 o'clock in the evening, if you look to the south and then look slightly to the right and up towards the point over the top of your head, you will see it there. You can't miss it. It's absolutely obvious. It's sort of got a creamy, pale hue to it. And like I say, it won't flicker or twinkle because it's a planet.
Okay, what else can I see?
There's lots to see out there. The most obvious one is the moon, which obviously you see the different phases of the moon through the month.
The different faces?
Phases. Okay. All faces. You can see a Cheshire Cat smile early on in the moon's phase.
Okay, and so the whole idea of the phases of the moon, which is it a new moon, which is a full moon is when it's a complete circle, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. When you see the full moon, that's usually it's the moon halfway through its monthly cycle, and it's opposite the sun at that point, so you see the full face of the moon. When it's new, it's when it's actually with the sun, travelling with the sun, so you don't actually see the moon at all.
Now, this is one of these weird little things that I picked up from a long, long time ago. Is that the sun, am I right, maybe you can put me straight on this, that actually if you look at them in the sky, I mean you don't look at the sun obviously because it does your eyes in, but they are actually the same, even though the moon is 90 something million miles away and the sun is 90 million miles away and the moon is it 750,000 or 250,000 miles away?
Yeah, the easier way to do it, Tony, is that the sun is 400 times larger than the moon, but the moon is 400 times closer to the Earth, so therefore they appear to be the same size.
That's amazing, isn't it? They almost exactly the same size. Something a bit freaky about that.
Yeah, we live in a very fortunate time because you know the moon is slowly moving away from the Earth, and in millions of years you won't get eclipses like we get now at the moment, because the moon will be too small to create that effect.
So is it flying off, is it?
Yeah, it's slowly moving away, about a centimetre a year.
Okay, we won't take it personally.
Nope.
Anyway, where can I go for more information?
There's loads of resources online, Tony, websites, you know.
What about clubs, anything like that in the city?
Yeah, if you go online again, you'll find plenty in Bristol, you know, astronomical clubs. You can do, there's various types you can do. You can do armchair astronomy, as they call it, with a bit of software on your computer, or you can get out there and have a look.
Okay, finally, any good sort of guide to the night sky to find the constellations that you could recommend?
Yeah, there's one called Stellarium, which is a free download on the web. And also, now with smartphones, you can get loads of apps. And if you point your phone at the sky, it'll actually show you what you're looking at on the display.
Fantastic. Paul Fernie, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Tony.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Jeff Sparks, you got the What's On Guide?
Yes, I have. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 15th of March, Crowhailer will be performing with support from The Hyde at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 15th of March, Roddy Woomble of Idlewild fame will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 each and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Los Cryptozoos. This group hail from Spain and recently have won the award for BCFM Sunday Rock Show's Album of the Year 2012. This is from the album La Danza del Cadáver and is a song titled On Alta Mar. Cryptozoos with On Alta Mar from the album La Danza del Cadáver. You can download the whole album from Los Cryptozoos, that is LOSCRIPTOZOOS, loscryptozoosband.bandcamp.com. On to Saturday 16th of March, at First Degree Burns, we'll be performing with support from Castle and also James and the Peach at Mr. Wolfson's in Stephen Street, Bristol. Entry is £4 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 17th of March, Alex Taylor will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and the gig starts around 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care, and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. And if you're listening online, I, Tony Gosling, am going to do the BCFM Politics Show, Friday drive time, every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. That's live, that one. And if you're in the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, that's Maurice Kirk this week, also Mark Higgins and Paul Fernie. Dialects are Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye. Thank you.